Hello and welcome to the History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and if you would like to listen to this or previous episodes of the programme, go to nearpodcast.org/pcast/. As always, I'm joined by my co-presenter John Dorney of the IrishStory.com website. This week we are going to look at fascism and anti-fascism in Ireland, and we are very pleased to be joined by Dr. Brian Hanley and Dr. Fergal McGarry. Dr. Brian Hanley is the author of The IRA, A Documentary History, 1919 to 2005, The IRA, 1926 to 1936, and, with Scott Miller, The Lost Revolution, The Story of the Official IRA and the Workers' Party. He teaches history at the University of Liverpool. Dr. Fergal McGarry is a senior lecturer in modern history at Queen's University, Belfast. He has written a series of books on Irish republicanism, including Irish Politics and the Spanish Civil War, Frank Ryan, Owen O'Duffy, A Self-Made Hero, and The Rising Ireland Easter 1916, and edited the collection Republicanism in Modern Ireland. His latest book is Rebels. You're very welcome to the programme. Now, Brian, if I could start with you, could you define what is fascism?
Well, it's difficult because I think the most successful fascist movements were always rooted in their own local conditions, and therefore it differs from place to place. I mean, the movement that gives the phenomenon its name arose obviously in Italy. But Italian fascism differed in certain ways from German Nazism, although I would argue that they were part of the same general phenomenon. And then right across Europe, you have movements that arise in the post-Great War period, which often involve war veterans or ex-servicemen, which often mobilise people from what might be broadly called the lower middle class or the middle class, who are terrified of the threat of socialism and revolution, which is very real in the post-war period, who are often very angered by what they perceive as the crushing or the isolation of the middle class by both the left and what they see as conservative capitalism. For example, the Nazis, you know, use terms like little man who speaks for you, and what they mean is the middle class man who doesn't have the unions but who doesn't have big business either. Hitler at one point is asked, is he a revolutionary? And he says, well, if I am, I'm a revolutionary against revolution. So there is very much this sense that they are holding the line for traditional society against these forces that are trying to destroy it. So in theory, at least, there's this opposition to both capitalism and socialism. The reality is usually very different.
And John, do you get the feeling that in the interwar period in Europe there was a feeling that democracy was a failed experiment?
Yeah, I mean, this was definitely an idea that was in the air in Europe. I mean, obviously it depended on how fractured the political situation was in a given country and how much experience of democracy they'd had. I mean, in relatively mature democracies like Britain and France, democracy survived despite the fact that there was fascist movements in both of those countries. In places where democracy was of shorter vintage, like Germany, Italy, but all across a swathe of Eastern Europe, which is often forgotten about, democracy did fall. It was briefly established after the First World War and it fell quite quickly. And there was a lot of reasons for that. But I go along with what Brian was saying, that fascism was, in a lot of ways, it was a response to the crisis of capitalism. The Great Depression was obviously very important. It was a response to the rise of communism. One other thing, though, I'd like to bring up, which is important in Ireland, is that fascism is an extreme form of nationalism. Fascism says that the nation is the only important thing, really, in politics, and it has to fight against its enemies, whether they be internal, whether they be communists, whether they be national minorities, like the Jews, of course. But there was also a thing like called separatist nationalism, or we might call it like that, in, for example, in Croatia, where extreme Croatian movements, extreme Croatian nationalists were fascists, the Ustasha, and there's parallels in that in some other places as well. So fascism was a range of phenomena, but it basically was anti-democratic. It was extreme nationalist. It was usually militarist as well. It believed in the use of violence as a virtue, which again has echoes in Ireland in a lot of ideologies. And in many places in Europe, yeah, people did think that democracy was not capable of solving the problems of the post-Great War world.
And Fergal, how do you think that in Ireland, the Civil War and its legacy contributed to this challenge to democracy?
Yeah, if I could just add to the point that John has made. I mean, I agree very much. I think Brian's given us a really good outline of fascism and its emergence, and John, of course, is right to say that fascism is explicitly anti-democratic, and that's one of the real tests, I think, of, you know, what's genuinely a fascist, whether there's a very explicit sort of opposition to democracy. But there's a slightly more nuanced aspect to this, which we have to think about, which is, you know, if you look at Europe in the immediate post-war period, there's this sense that liberal democracy is be, you know, the end of history, as someone else said at the other end of the 20th century, that all the new states are going to have constitutions and they'll be liberal and they will have participatory democracy. And if you fast forward into the, you know, early 1930s, mid-1930s, you've almost got the other extreme. You've got extreme pessimism about democracy, and people are writing its obituary, including, you know, in Ireland. And one of the reasons for this is that fascism, although being anti-democratic, was proved to be much more effective than liberal democracy in sort of mobilising the masses and having roots in popular sentiment, whereas liberal democracy seemed to be something which had more support amongst, you know, intellectuals and older political elites, but seemed to be much more, much less successful in sort of getting mass support and getting people on the street to support it. So while fascism is anti-democratic, it proved perhaps far more effective than liberal democracy in actually sort of engendering mass support in the interwar period. So there's an interesting kind of paradox there. Now, in terms of the Civil War, I think if we were to compare Ireland to other European states, there'd be you know, some reasons for pessimism about democracy establishing itself. Probably two main issues for two main reasons for pessimism. One, the new successor states, as John mentioned, that emerged in the post-war period tended not to survive. And you can make an argument that by 1939, Ireland is, in fact, the Irish Free State is the only successor state which remains kind of fully democratic in a liberal fashion. But the second kind of major question mark about Irish democracy is the Civil War, because it was a characteristic of those states in which democracy collapsed that they had gone through civil war. So it made it very difficult to build democratic structures when there was that background. I would argue what Ireland perhaps has in its favour in terms of the Civil War is that one would expect the fascist movement in a post-Civil War politics to emerge from the nationalist side of things. So a fascist movement might have been thought to emerge from anti-treaty politics, but instead you have a particularly strong democratic force under De Valera, and you, you know, paradoxically in some ways have the fascist threat emerging from the more established side of things. So the Civil War is part of the problem, but it's not a sort of a straightforward how that sort of tends to work in terms of undermining democracy in the interwar period.
Brian, just to pick up on that point, that you see in a lot of Irish historiography, this distinction between democrats and dictators when they refer to the Civil War, and the different sides in regard to the treaty. But does that really deal at all with maybe the latent anti-democratic tendencies on certain parts of the pro-treaty side during the Civil War?
No, it doesn't really. I suppose it was more the trend up till relatively recently that tended to be the shorthand for what the Civil War was about, that the treaty had won a popular mandate, and then this group of anti-democrats rejected it. And there are obviously elements on the anti-treaty side who didn't really care whether or not the treaty had a mandate, but the situation was a lot more complicated than that. And without going on at length, you know, there's another player in this argument, which is Britain, which hadn't left the 26 counties and which had a bigger army than anybody else, and which wants one side to win, and that's important. And that does qualify, you know, how popular this mandate actually is, because there is a threat of war if the treaty is rejected. Plus, the pro-treatyites themselves openly during the war make clear that they don't really care about the rule of law. I mean, Sean McKeown, when he's challenged in the Dáil about, you know, the legality of some of the executions, says, you know, no lawyer is going to tell me what I have to do, you know. So there was a strong militaristic, anti-democratic trend on the pro-treaty side. They happened to be fighting to establish a government at the time, but some of them were quite clear then and in later life that, you know, they were convinced they were right and they were happy to use any methods to make sure they won.
And if I could just jump in there, perhaps we could make a distinction between fascist movements or states and authoritarian ones, because the term fascist is often used as a blanket term to, you know, to comprise any undemocratic right-wing movement. So Franco, for example, successful fascist movements were really unusual. It's one of the difficulties in trying to sort of define fascism, because the two good examples, the two most successful examples we have, Germany and Italy, are very different, you know, in all sorts of ways. But what is a much more common trend in the interwar period is authoritarian states, very often too coming from political cultures which are rooted in a kind of a Catholic background. So if we look at, you know, Spain or certain of the states in Eastern Europe, you have the emergence of a lot of authoritarian movements, and often very successfully transforming themselves into authoritarian states. But for the most part, these tend to come from the same places where the threat, as we'll see, emerges in Ireland. They come from, you know, the security forces, the police, the army, you know, traditional conservative forces, often backed by the Catholic Church. And, you know, going back to Brian's original point, what's often propelling this is not so much a positive agenda as a negative one, a fear of, you know, socialism, republicanism, modernisation, democratisation and so on, and a desire to hold on to older gains.
I agree with that, but I think that one kind of unspoken aspect of the Civil War is the element of class conflict, particularly in the countryside in Ireland, which I think is very important what we're going to talk about in the Blue Shirt Movement and the IRA, because the fascism, if that's what it was, of the Blue Shirts, is of a type in Europe which is, if you like, the reaction. It's counter-revolutionary. It wants to promote social order. It wants to consolidate, if you like, the existing classes. And in Ireland, like, once the landlords had gone, and they'd mostly gone by night after the Windham Act, the strongest classes were the farmers, you know, the cattle raisers and so forth. And they were, in general, they were pro-treatyites in the Civil War. In the Civil War, never adopted by the Republicans, but very present and very concerning to the government, was rural strikes, land occupations, and the army was used to put these down with the support of the same people who supported the Free State government for constitutional reasons. So I think that the kind of consolidation of what they would have seen as law and order against what they would have seen as the anarchy and possible communism of the Republicans is an important element here. And the other thing I want to say, though, is that democracy is not only threatened in Europe from the right, it's also threatened from the left. And while left Republicans are a minority, I think there's something in seeing in the IRA a certain amount of revolutionary anti-democratic ideology. I mean, famously, Rory O'Connor said, "We'll have it." Yeah, when he was asked if you'll take it, if we're going to have a military dictatorship in the Civil War, he says, "You can take it that way if you want." Now, that was probably a spur of the moment thing. But Ernie O'Malley wrote, "If we consulted the people, we never would have fired a shot," which is the authentic kind of revolutionary mentality. And I think it's the clashing of two not necessarily democratic forces, one of which wants revolution, partly nationalist, some of them want social revolution, and the other side, which wants basically to consolidate the social order. I think that's part of the story here too.
Brian, if I could just bring up the 1932 election, when we look at some of the election posters and stuff like that, it seems bizarre now looking back, but this portrayal as De Valera as at best an Irish Kerensky, or possibly some Trojan horse for bringing in communism, and Fianna Fáil being like a byword for communism and violent revolution and the IRA at its back. It seems bizarre now, but how seriously was that message taken by particularly a lot of the pro-treaty supporters in Ireland, or the coming in ale supporters in Ireland?
I think there's a few different factors there. One, there was a cynical use of that fear by Cosgrave and by other people in the government to, one, try and get the backing of the Catholic hierarchy, which they did in the winter of 1931 for their Red Scare. They hoped that Red Scare would also be used against Fianna Fáil, because there were Fianna Fáil people involved in groups like Saor Éire and very closely linked to the IRA. But there also was genuinely fear among the pro-treatyites, both among the elite and among their ordinary supporters, which is more important in some ways, that of course there was going to be a revenge for the Civil War. You know, it was less than a decade before. You know, they'd been Cumann na Gael ministers such as Kevin O'Higgins, who's obviously assassinated in 1927. Again, that's an element of in their thinking, what's going to happen to the rest of us once these guys get to power. But O'Higgins had famously said, you know, never mind the 77, we'd have executed 777 if we had to. Now, if you're a pro-treatyite, you're obviously going to be thinking in 1932, well, these guys remember that, and what are they going to do? At best, are they going to simply, you know, purge the civil service and sack everybody who supports us? At worst, are they going to start, you know, killing us? So there's a genuine atmosphere of fear. And into that, you also have these other fears. The press are talking about De Valera being an Irish Kerensky. You know, the Russian Revolution, the failed revolutions in Europe are all very, very near in terms of people's experience. All those ideas are out there, and they do merge into this fear of what's going to happen once these anti-treatyites get power, which is why people like Ona Duffy do discuss in the corridors of power the possibility of stopping them with a coup.
And Fergal, maybe you could tell us who the Army Comrades Association were and why it was set up.
Yeah, sure. If I could just add to, I mean, I agree with what Brian's saying, but if I could just add to, again, I think the international comparison is perhaps useful in terms of thinking what's happening in 1932, because we have a useful kind of analogy with what happens in Spain, where you have a successful, democratically successful Republican government being formed in 1931-32, and they kind of do some of the things that that people feared would happen in Ireland. You know, and they annoyed similar interest groups, the army, certain form of nationalism, the Catholic Church, and so on. And they did so by sort of acting quite radically. But when you see De Valera come to power, there's a really kind of interesting, you know, difference, because he acts very cautiously, and he's very careful not to give to his IRA radical supporters what they're demanding for, you know, getting rid of the special branch and sacking civil servants and so on. He's very careful to conciliate the Catholic Church and conservative interests. You know, he moves very cautiously. So I think some of what, quite a lot of what's going on, we do need to think about sort of the actions of the political elite, even though political scientists tend to emphasize structural aspects more. So there is that element to it. But then the other sort of element in my comparison with Spain is, you know, very different societies. If you look at the kind of the problems there, there was, you know, huge problems with land and the lack of land redistribution. There was real class hatred. There was enormous differences in terms of poverty and levels of income and so on. There was a much less kind of popular support and elite support for democracy. So I think we need to sort of think of both aspects, or very different aspects in terms of those contexts. Now, in terms of the ACA, the emergence of the ACA is quite characteristic of the emergence of fascist movements elsewhere in Europe, as Brian mentioned earlier. And it was very kind of typical for a fascist political party to have its first kind of origins as a movement of former army comrades. But again, here we need to be perhaps a little bit careful, because, you know, a central distinction in terms of, or central characteristic of, the emergence of fascist movements in many European countries was, that fascist movements emerged from a defeated wartime experience, whereas the picture is much more complicated in Ireland, because Ireland's involvement in the Great War was, you know, politically much more complicated and peripheral. And, you know, it's difficult to make the case that Ireland was a defeated power in the 1920s. And the other kind of complication here is that typically you find that these ex-soldiers movements, like the Nazis or the Italian fascists, that they kind of, you know, they talk about erasing the shame of wartime defeat and building a new powerful national state. And, you know, nationalism is really at the centre of their message. But the Army Comrades Association are of course, formed by pro-treatyites, and, you know, not just were they successful in the Civil War, but their kind of political vision, such as it is very much bound in with supporting the treaty. It is keeping Ireland tied into a position of a relationship with Britain. So, you know, I think that blunts the popular appeal of the ACA. They can appeal to a significant core of people, pro-treatyites, but that's, you know, not a widespread appeal of the kind that for example, the Nazis can tap into in Germany.
The potential for a coup in 1932, how strong do you think that was at the time?
It's a tricky one, because I think the fact that democracy survived in the interwar period in Ireland tends to make us very complacent about that, and we sort of take that for granted. But again, I'll go back to an earlier point, which is that the survival of democracy in a new state that was formed after the Great War period was really unusual. So I think we have to be careful about complacency. But as I've already suggested, there's quite a lot of structural reasons why fascism or authoritarianism couldn't gain the same kind of purchase in Ireland, and their, you know, socio-economic, cultural, and so on. One thing which we haven't really mentioned is the British legacy, and Britain must accept responsibility for all sorts of shortcomings in Ireland. But for different reasons, the Free State inherited a fairly good hand in terms of building democracy in 1922. I mean, you have the paradox, for example, that Irish nationalists were very adept at using democracy. Ireland had one of the most sort of sophisticated and popular sort of histories of, you know, democratic mobilisation going back to the mid-19th century. You know, in other respects, you know, more kind of mundane matters of institutions and law and order and so on, Ireland had benefited from the Union in all sorts of ways. For example, a fairly well, you know, educated society, and so on. So, we need to think about those broad factors. In the short term, though, there's no doubt that you have extreme elements within the National Army and within the police who would have been willing to short-circuit democracy in order to keep the Treatyites in power. I think you're probably looking at a very small number of senior politicians within Cumann na n-Éill. The name Ernest Blyde is usually mentioned in this context, and a very small number of individuals at the higher end in the National Army and the police force. And of course, Ona Duffy appears to be the key shaker and mover during the period leading up to the transition of power. But I think while it's all a bit murky, when you look closely at it, it does seem that while O'Duffy was willing to, you know, talk the talk of having a coup and so on, that really he could gain quite little support in doing so. So the threat was there. It was the kind of threat which was commonplace in Europe and brought down democracies. But I think at the end of the day, it probably wasn't a hugely significant threat.
Yeah, I suppose I do maybe take issue a little bit with the assumption that the, you know, the strength of Irish democracy marked it out from other places where fascism was successful. I mean, you wouldn't have actually singled out Germany as one of these backward successor states. And actually Germany had, for example, a very large and sophisticated labour movement, had a lot of experience, even though it was, you know, they had an emperor, but they also had a parliament prior to the Great War. And what was key, I think, is the level of crisis that affected the society, particularly in Germany after the Depression, and also the attitude then of German conservatives who actually didn't like the Nazis, who looked down on Hitler, who thought he was actually an Austrian upstart and a bit of a madman, but at the end of the day were forced to take a bet on him. Now, the crisis in Ireland never reached that proportion. But you do think up till 1934, a lot of people in Fine Gael always reflect on, well, once they saw how out of control Ona Duffy was getting, the responsible leadership got rid of him. Up till the local elections in 1934, when he was expanding the party, they were bigger than they'd ever been. They were flourishing at local level away, Cumann na n-Éill never had. And he was promising great gains. The Conservatives in the party weren't seeing a whole lot wrong with him. So I think, you know, that aspect has to be taken into consideration. And just on the point of nationalism, I think Fergal is right about the ACA's roots in Treatyite politics. But also what's very apparent about the Blue Shirts, particularly when they do become the Blue Shirts, which is, you know, a little bit later on, how much the legacy of 1916, how much the legacy of the revolution was important to them. I mean, they didn't march. Republicans used to accuse the Blue Shirts of being pro-British, which is the fallback position. The Blue Shirts didn't march around with Union Jacks. They didn't talk about how great the Commonwealth was. The Blue Shirts saw themselves as the successors of the men in 1916, the successors of the IRA, and there was real evidence for it. Lots of their local organisers had been in the IRA during the War of Independence. Then they joined the Free State Army, but as far as they were concerned, they'd done what Collins had done. And remember the significance of Collins as an iconic figure for the Blue Shirts. The spirit of Michael Collins is abroad again today. Who will cry halt to us? I think that's very important. That aspect of Treatyite nationalism, I think, is important for the Blue Shirts, because they'd never have gotten as far as they did if they were simply just, you know, a group that was going around talking about how great the treaty had been in terms of how it had maintained Ireland's position within the British family of nations.
Yeah, I would agree with a lot of that, and I think we need to be really conscious of the rewriting of history that went on when, you know, figures like Ernest Blyde and so on looked back in the Blue Shirt period, and people were very quickly to put all the blame on O'Duffy, and clearly sort of anti-democratic sentiment was more widespread than that. But I think, I'm sure we're going to get into this in more detail later, but I think there are, you know, clear differences between, say, the Blue Shirt movement and fascist movements elsewhere in terms of the extent to which the radicalism filtered down to the grassroots. So I think people like Ona Duffy were perhaps unusual in that they do seem to have been, they do seem to have been genuine believers in the notion of fascism, the radicalism of fascism, to the extent that they sort of understood it. But it's quite difficult to find evidence of that kind of radicalism in the grassroots of the Blue Shirt movement and their political vision. I agree very much with what Brian's saying about Treatyite nationalism. Their political vision, I think, is a more conservative nationalist one. And it's also, strangely enough, despite chopping down lampposts and attacking the police and so on. It's also bound up in notions of kind of being the party of law and order and traditional values and so on. So they're an unlikely sort of fascist movement in that sense.
Well, John, just before we go to break, I might ask you, why did the Army Comrades Association, why did former pro-treatyites feel the need to organise? What was the justification they were using?
Well, again, if we go back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, which was Fianna Fáil come to power, and there is a great panic among pro-treatyites, partly because of, as Brian mentioned, the legacy of the Civil War. I mean, we can't enumerate here all the murders and the executions and so forth that happened in the Civil War, but people were afraid of revenge. And remember that De Valera released the several hundred IRA prisoners who had been in prison under emergency legislation. He'd legalised the IRA, he incorporated some of them in the police. I think that was a little bit later, but he did that. The people, O'Duffy and the Army Comrades Association, who became the Blue Shirts, also, they genuinely did fear that this was the start of social revolution to some extent. And remember that these did represent, if you like, not the very highest echelons of Irish society, but certainly the farming class, the people who had some property. They did see this as a possible start to social anarchy and social revolution. So what vehicle do you adopt in 1930s Europe to restore law and order, to fight what you think is the radical left wing? You adopt the vehicle of fascism, the stiff arm salute, the uniforms, the marching. And I think that that was basically the genesis of the Blue Shirts. Now, something else, if we talk about the realm of ideology and high politics, we get one picture. But at ground level, the IRA was committed to this platform of no free speech for traitors, which had actually themselves been adopted from left-wing Europe, left-wing discourse in Europe, as no free speech for fascists to no free speech for traitors. The IRA was beaten up. Coming to nail supporters, pro-treaty supporters. They were breaking up their rallies, and the Blue Shirts were in some respects a street fighting organisation. They were geared towards brawling basically with Republicans and with IRA and Fianna Fáil supporters.
We're just going to take a very quick break and we will be back shortly. And we're back, and I'll just throw this question over to Brian Hanley about some of the violence on the ground between the IRA and the Blue Shirts in that period.
Well, firstly, I think it's important to remember violence wasn't unusual in Irish electoral contests. Even prior to independence, violence had been often endemic in elections between rival groups within the Home Rule movement, between Republicans and Nationalists and Unionists. So clashes at elections were common enough, but what gave added impetus in 1932 and 1933 was this fear that Fianna Fáil were about to unleash some kind of terror on the defeated Cumann na Gael's side. And at a local level, there are certainly all sorts of relatively minor scores being settled in terms of fights between pro and anti-treaty supporters. Again, when you examine it, with most of these things, you find that both sides accuse each other of having started the violence. And there's a number of local clashes which begin to escalate, particularly in the winter of 1932 and into 1933, between Cumann na Gael meetings being broken up, not just by the IRA, but also by Fianna Fáil supporters. Clashes between individuals after events. And then this, as the Army Comrades Association begins to function as a defence group for the Cumann na Gael party, you have an extension of these clashes. What's interesting, I suppose, in terms of the IRA's politics, is that the organisation's leadership, most of them, were very eager to avoid clashes because they thought this was going to lead to De Valera clamping down on them, and they wanted to build up the IRA as an armed force and train and all the rest of it. And actually their membership rebelled against them. What you often have is very much local indiscipline, where if Cumann na Gael have a rally, the local Republicans are gonna try and break it up no matter what the IRA leadership say. So you have this clash within the Republican movement of what they're supposed to be doing. The left in the IRA, once they identify the ACA as fascist, which they do from a pretty early stage, then begin to argue that it's legitimate to attack them and that the IRA should be taking the lead in attacking them. And this also becomes an issue then in the divide within the IRA itself about what political direction it's taken. So it's very often, it's very widespread. I mean, you know, most political events are accompanied by some form of clashes, which the police are involved in as well. But it does begin to, by late 1933, get very, very serious. So the army are called in to back up the Gardaí at clashes in Tralee and Kilkenny and Drogheda. The Irish army fix bayonets and clear the streets with bayonet charges. They use tear gas, for example, to clear crowds. So this is quite extensive violence.
If I could just jump in there to the other thing I'd mentioned, in terms of you know, the depths and the scale of the sort of political violence for the period, in fatalities it's quite low, but as Brian says, in terms of sort of, you know, mobilisation on the streets and the strength of the emotions that are stirred. It's really strong. I think what we're looking at is the convergence of two different powerful reasons for conflict. One is, you know, that the election of Fianna Fáil almost brings back a sort of a return to civil war hatreds and passions and fears. But the second, of course, is that Fianna Fáil's economic policy, its economic war with Britain, essentially is a direct attack on the economic interests of the most powerful class in our society, which is large farmers, as you recall, by the left, ranchers and graziers and so on. But you know, the bulk of the farming middle class also. And I think a lot of, in many rural areas, I think that the real anger is actually generated by the economic war. But of course, it dovetails with that political conflict. And I think those two things coming together, you know, does make for a significant threat to the political system, and one that required, you know, a pretty serious and skillful law and order response by De Valera. But even in making that response, De Valera had to deal with a lot of tricky issues. I mean, he didn't particularly trust the National Army, and there was a lot of resentment of De Valera by the National Army, which was essentially a pro-treaty force. He obviously had good grounds not to trust the police either, with figures like, you know, Ona Duffy, and again, it's very much a treaty-out force in its origins. And of course, De Valera himself, in terms of, you know, he didn't have an overall majority in 1932 to 1933, and he very much sympathised with the Republican rhetoric used by the IRA against the state. So it was a, you know, extremely difficult sort of political position for De Valera to bring himself from the sort of 1932-33 period to, you know, 1934-35, when he effectively succeeded in marginalising both the right and the left, or the pro-treaty and anti-treaty extremes in Irish politics.
So, Brian, I might just put it to you. How popular were really authoritarian ideas in Ireland, things like fascism, anti-Semitism, and perhaps on a wider level, things like vocationalism?
Well, I think you have to draw a distinction between a number of things there. One, anti-Semitism was a very widespread and common prejudice, which was completely acceptable in a way that it isn't today. So you would have all sorts of people who would hold anti-Semitic ideas and suspicions about Jews, and then you would have a relatively large minority of people who were, you know, quite seriously anti-Semitic, and who were, some of them, quite obsessed, as anti-Semites tend to be, with this theory. You know, well before the Blue Shirts, there were Cumann na Gael TDs who would say in the Dáil that the Jews controlled Dublin. I mean, language like that, it wasn't commonplace, certainly, you know, in the 20s, but it existed, and it wouldn't have drawn the kind of outrage that it would today. By the time the Blue Shirts come along, it's ingrained in politics, and it's not essential to their movement in a way that it is to other fascist movements in Europe. But you do have individuals within Fine Gael who will constantly reference the fact that De Valera is not really an Irishman and really comes from somewhere else, and actually, you know, the bastard son of a Spanish Jew, for example. They'll also be quite obsessed with the fact that there is one Jewish TD, Bob Briscoe, who's in Fianna Fáil. And you'll have people at council meetings in Monaghan saying to Fianna Fáil councillors, sure, your party is run by the Jews in Dublin. And again, that's not central a lot of the time to the Blue Shirts argument, but it does exist in the ether, if you know what I mean, and it's something that many of them would have found when they want to abuse De Valera and they want to abuse Fianna Fáil. And the idea, again, that a lot of these ideas are foreign ideologies, you know, that would have been quite common. But it's something that's quite, you know, not necessarily the same as authoritarianism, and not even necessarily the same as fascism.
Fergal, could you talk about perhaps the idea of vocationalism and what it meant, and how widespread or how popular the idea was in Ireland at the time?
Yeah, I think this is an idea which is usefully talked about in terms of the political context of what's happening, particularly in the sort of the mid 1930s. I mean, there isn't an awful lot of support for vocational or corporatist ideas in our society, or certainly in Irish politics in the 1920s, although they're becoming increasingly fashionable in Europe. And essentially the idea of corporatism is that that parliamentary democracy isn't the be-all and end-all, that there may be different forms of representative government that might be more effective, and that emphasising the individual vote and democratic politics, which are the politics of kind of conflict and division, with political parties mobilizing on the basis of things like class and ethnicity and so on, that all of this democratic stuff is problematic, and that there might be better ways of governing in the interests of the nation. And one of these is to seek cooperation between classes by organizing democracy around sort of occupational representation. So you'd have, for instance, all the people who work the land together, industry together, you know, workers and employers and so on. And there's two sources for this kind of thinking. One is the Catholic Church, Pope Pius XII, I think, quite bad in pious numbers, produces Quadratissimo Animo in 1933, which advocates corporatism. But Catholic corporatism, which was really about devolving power from the state to occupational groups, is widely confused with the corporate state, which is something identified with Mussolini. And Mussolini tended to use corporatism more as a kind of fig leaf to cover the state basically monopolizing power. And in practice, corporatism in fascism tended to work by benefiting employers and the powerful. So you get this confusion between the two, which is kind of an issue. Now, corporatism sort of comes onto the Irish stage, I would argue, essentially because of the sort of the ideological vacuum that results within pro-treaty politics because of the successive defeat of Cumann na Éireann in two general elections in 1932 and 1933. And, you know, their leader, Cosgrave, resigns. They essentially don't really have a vision, and there's no mileage left in treaty-like politics, because that's really on the wrong side of the nationalist argument. So you get the sort of the adoption of corporatist ideas, which had been espoused by a number of treaty-eyed intellectuals, Michael Tierney and James Hogan, and these are being expressed within the Blue Shirt movement, within the National Guard. And I would argue, and others have done so too, that with no real kind of alternative political strategy or political kind of vision in 1933, when you get the merger between the Blue Shirts and Cumann na Éireann to create a new political party, that gives corporatism a much higher profile. But I think we can be pretty sceptical as to whether Cumann na Éireann en masse was won over to corporatist ideas. I think, you know, by and large, most of the political elite, whether Cumann na Éireann or Fianna Fáil, you know, were reasonably happy with the form of liberal electoral democracy that actually existed in Ireland, and there was, you know, quite little appetite to change it. So you have the curious kind of paradox that Ireland is perhaps, in terms of the ethos, you know, the most Catholic country in Europe, but it has a political system which is, you know, deeply kind of liberal and owes far more to sort of, you know, British liberal democracy than Catholic ideas of democracy such as corporatism.
And Brian, what did you find when you were researching and looking back at Fine Gael newspapers or coverage of the Roar Deshes? It just seems to me that, funnily enough, of most Irish political parties, Fine Gael seems to have done the most to sort of whitewash their history and their background. Like, you would very rarely hear a Fine Gaeler referring to Owen O'Duffy, and most of them would probably claim that W.T. Cosgrave was the first leader of Fine Gael.
Yeah, well, I think, I suppose in some ways it also leads on from what Fergal is saying, because if you look at Fine Gael party papers, and if you look at material published by the Blue Shirts in 1933-1934, you will see discussion of Italian corporatism, and you will see a lot of articles about how Italy was saved from communism by Mussolini and the corporate system. And what has an appeal, I think, to a lot of people is this idea that corporatism gets rid of class conflict. Class conflict, to a lot of people in Ireland, is seen as a bad thing, and especially if you're on the receiving end of it, if you're a big farmer, and they tend to regard any kind of system that can get rid of that as important. And you do see within the Blue Shirts, particularly in kind of the rhetoric of individual Blue Shirts, you know, that the people who support them aren't the people who are raised on free beef, for example. In other words, that, you know, the kind of people who support De Valera and Fianna Fáil are the lowest of the low, who are in it to get what they can, whereas the respectable, responsible people, the people who work hard, are the people who should be naturally involved with Fine Gael. I mean, I think James Hogan's brother Paddy, Minister for Agriculture, had said at one point that he wasn't worried about Fianna Fáil coming to power because you needed breeding to govern. And that in some ways reflects the kind of conservatism, but also in terms of its hatred of the idea of class conflict. Of course, it's all about class, but it doesn't like the idea of class conflict. Feeds into this why, you know, some forms of corporatism might be attractive. I mean, the first Fine Gael Ardesh is quite interesting because it's probably the, one of the few Fine Gael Ardeshes, maybe the only one, where the delegates send a message of support to their prisoners in Arbour Hill. Also, it's interrupted on several occasions by the delegates standing and giving the right arm salute. And you do hear things like the democratic system being described as not fit for Ireland, as, you know, I think Ernest Bligh used the term about, you know, parliaments have become these babbling houses, you know. So there's, whether it's all froth, you know, I'm not so sure. I think there is a basis to it. But certainly those ideas are in the air within early Fine Gael at that stage.
John?
One of the, I suppose, the popular narrative of the period is that O'Duffy threatened to imitate Mussolini with a march on Dublin and it was outlawed and that was the end of the Blue Shirts. Is that right or is that just a simplification?
Yeah, it's probably the beginning of the slippy slope, all right, because O'Duffy had the most amazing kind of political trajectory, because within just a couple of months of being fired from his position as Garda Commissioner, he's leader of the, within weeks, he's leader of the National Guard, but then within a couple of months, the National Guard merges with Cumann na n-Éill because, you know, Fianna Fáil is the government is rounding on the Blue Shirts, and this is the response. So this means that within just a couple of months of entering politics, O'Duffy is the leader of the opposition, and he is, and it's worth really emphasising, he's completely off his trolley. You know, he's a committed fascist. His rhetoric is incredibly extreme, not just about dispensing with democracy, but things like invading Northern Ireland. He's got all sorts of personal and emotional issues. You know, he's probably a high-functioning alcoholic. And this does sort of put into perspective the notion of, which we've mentioned a few times, of political crisis. There is at that particular moment a political crisis. I suppose one of the reasons for O'Duffy's appeal is he's seen as a hard man. He is projected as having a great kind of nationalist record. So he's, as Brian mentioned earlier, he perhaps is the next, the Michael Collins that has been looked for. And I think what's kind of fatal about, you know, what happens with the banning of the march is that it's the first big test. And, you know, he fluffs it. And people are very quick to make the analogy with O'Connell at Clontarf. And from that point on, when Fianna Fáil is attacking the Blue Shirts and O'Duffy can posture as a patriot, he's in quite a good position, and Fianna Fáil learn how difficult it is to use the law to try and prescribe political parties. So ironically, they're trying to do to O'Duffy what O'Duffy had difficulties doing to anti-treaty Republicans. But as soon as sort of you know, the tensions within Fine Gael come to the fore, and in a sense Fine Gael are sort of left alone to stew in their own ideological incoherencies, you begin to have these enormous tensions, and you also see with the local elections that perhaps not only are there internal tensions, but there isn't any sign that there's huge political gains being made for all this radicalism, which to be honest appalls some of the older, more traditional Cumann na n-Éill elements, given their, you know, their civil war legacy as the party of law and order.
Brian, what is the response at this stage from Republicans, non-Fianna Fáil Republicans?
The IRA would have opposed a march on Dublin. I think there's a lot of legends about what they intended to do. I've never seen any evidence from IRA documents that they were going to actually open fire on this march, which some people believe. They would have opposed it by simply mobilising lots of people, and there would have been extensive rioting, and the army probably would have been, you know, called out. So there would have been an intensive street conflict, but I'm not sure other than that what would have happened. Interestingly, I mean, I think Fergal is right that it's probably the start of the beginning of the end, but often you find that initially the Blue Shirts actually gain a bit of momentum because O'Duffy goes on a nationwide tour or a statewide tour then, and actually the movement grows for a while on the back of this repression from the government and the intensive kind of conflict, because even though the conflict might appall some people within Cumann na n-Éill and later Fine Gael, a lot of young people are drawn into the Blue Shirts because of the prospect of conflict and because of what... I mean, you see a lot of young guys who are way too young to have been in the Free State Army or the IRA who become involved in the Blue Shirts because this is, you know, it becomes back to this is our community or this is our locality, and we're opposed to this other lot. So there is that kind of boost to the movement as well.
I think the group of people who would have been clearly anti-democratic, perhaps doctrinaire fascists even, within the Blue Shirts was really tiny. I think you're just looking at a number of individuals like Ona Duffy and some people who aren't really known as public names like Tom Cunning. The more influential ideological element within the Blue Shirts are the corporatists, people like Tierney and Hogan, And it's sometimes the line, I think, is too easily blurred between being corporatist and being anti-democratic or being even authoritarian or fascist. And if you look at their rhetoric, I mean, the corporatists within the blue shirts do say things which are critical of liberal democracy, and they say things which sort of argue that if it's between communism and fascism, we support fascism and so on. But you know, essentially, they weren't fascists, and they also were more conservative in terms of things like violence and the North and so on, the other issues which we've been touching on. And it's actually this group which eventually, I think, pulled the plug on O'Duffy. It's when James Hogan, who's one of the vice presidents, resigns after yet another of O'Duffy's very radical speeches, that O'Duffy's position becomes untenable. So I suppose that points to the need to look quite closely at the ideological divisions within the blue shirts themselves. So these corporatists did want kind of new forms of political thought. They were willing to really consider quite radical modifications of liberal democracy. And, you know, perhaps not surprising when you're thinking of what's happening in other European countries in this period, but most of them weren't up for an extreme kind of fascist agenda.
The blue shirts were obviously a big scare, but of course, in the end, it fizzled out. There was no fascist takeover in Ireland. The most radical elements of both sides, both fascist and anti-fascist, went to fight in the Spanish Civil War. But, Brian, as regards the memory, I mean, we hear people even today call blue shirts as a term of abuse. What do you think about the memory of the blue shirts?
I think what's interesting about it is how, on the one hand, people in Fine Gael can be embarrassed by it, but on the other hand, why there is within that party actually a strong nostalgia for it up until relatively recently. I mean, if you look at Ard Eisiúis in 1983, when it was the 50th anniversary of the founding of Fine Gael, Olivia O'Leary in the Irish Times noted that the two biggest cheers from the audience went up when the big screen showed pictures of Michael Collins and then Eoin O'Duffy. And during the same year, there was a special event held at the Mansion House on the 50th anniversary. And James Dillon, who again actually didn't come from the Sinn Féin background, but former Fine Gael leader, gave a speech. And in that speech, very, very, very vociferously defended the legacy of the Blue Shirts and argued that they were necessary to defend democracy, and named them as, you know, without the Blue Shirts, you know, we would have gone down to dictatorship. And he brought the house down. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Today, there are still people within Fine Gael. I mean, there's some Fine Gael TDs have pictures of the blue shirts on their websites and who do see them as a movement that was needed to defend the party from what they regard as the anti-democrats of Fianna Fáil. So I think there's a mixed legacy, and I suppose because it became a kind of a term of abuse that robs it of a lot of its meaning when it's used in elections now, that it has rather lost sight of the fact that they were an important phenomenon, if for a brief period of time.
Fergal, how would you feel about the historiography of the Blue Shirts and Fine Gael and how it's covered by Irish historians?
Yeah, if I just firstly just add briefly to Brian's point. I mean, I think Brian's right. There was a nostalgia for the Blue Shirts. And I think also it's quite easy to make a case, in favour of the Blue Shirts, and they do it themselves quite well. Like, you know, one of their strongest arguments is that they were defending free speech. You know, they were defending free speech for come-the-nail politicians to go onto public platforms and state their case in 1932 and 33 against the undemocratic attacks of the IRA, and I think that's legitimate. I think also they have other kind of, you know, there's other cases they can make. In terms of the economic war, there's a strong argument that what De Valera was doing was unjust, irresponsible, counterproductive, and so on. So they were able to tap into a lot of support for that. I think also you can make the case that at least it was easy for Blue Shirts to make the case that De Valera was a disturbing figure in 1930s politics. Here's this guy who is seen as the wrecker of the Civil War period, and he's brought back into politics in 1932, and he begins very radically sort of assaulting the Free State constitution and the political structures that have been put in place by Cumnail. You know, for example, when the Senate don't pass a piece of legislation banning the wearing of uniforms, he simply scraps the Senate. So I think if we cast ourselves back to the period, it's quite easy to empathise, I suppose, with many of the blue shirt arguments. But against all that, you can just set one powerful thing, which is the visual iconography of fascism. You know, no one's really going to make a case for the blue shirts when you have pictures of blue shirts wearing the blue shirt and doing fascist style salutes. I mean, that, to my mind, that just ends any kind of argument about where public sympathies should lie, and I think that will always remain the case. In terms of historiography, I suppose what we can point to is there's been a sort of a growing sophistication in terms of the addressing the question of whether blue shirts fascists. The first person to sort of tackle this was Maurice Manning in the early 1970s, and Maurice Manning's answer was essentially, no, they weren't. They had some of the characteristics of fascists, but essentially they weren't the real thing. But the historiography has kind of moved on in terms of asking more sophisticated questions. So rather than saying, you know, where do blue shirts fascists or not, the question is more, where do we put the blue shirts in the political spectrum between, you know, right-wing, authoritarian and fascist movements? And most would agree that the blue shirts probably belongs, you know, had they been successful under O'Duffy, they probably would have been the kind of movement you see in many European Catholic countries, such as Franco's Spain, that would have been authoritarian, but it would have been conservative rather than radical.
John? On that point, I mean, the Second World War gave fascists in a lot of parts of Europe the opportunity to show what they could really do, and we know what happened, not only in the Holocaust, but also in Yugoslavia, in Romania and various countries. And question to both of you, but first of all to you, Brian, does this totally change the way that we look at fascism, and does it make us judge the blue shirts too harshly to judge them by the standards of the Holocaust and mass murder in Central Europe?
You can't judge fascists too harshly. They weren't very good before the Holocaust. I think, of course, it influences the way that we see all these movements, and particularly, as Fergal said, the iconography of the uniform and the salute are now embedded in people's minds with the horrors of the Holocaust. But I think, you know, broadly, I think what historiography up till relatively recently, as Fergal said, was it did tend to have, I think, a Treatyite bias. I mean, Maurice Manning, his book is very valuable in many ways, but he is, you know, a Fine Gael politician. And similarly, a lot of other people who wrote books about Irish political history did tend to write from a Treatyite bias. So, for example, Michael Laffin, in his book on Sinn Féin, when he talks a little bit about the blue shirts, you know, describes them as basically defensive and harmless, and certainly not in any way as extreme as the IRA. And I think that reflects, in many ways, how historians and political scientists felt about Irish politics. I think what you've seen in the last decade is a more nuanced look at the other elements of authoritarian, anti-democratic politics, and also trying to place the blue shirts, as Fergal has said, in the kind of canon of European right-wing movements of the 1930s, which includes fascist elements, includes Catholic right elements, and different forms of authoritarian politics as well.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of the show. Thank you very much to Dr. Brian Hanley and Dr. Fergal McGarry, and also to John Dorney. So if you want to listen to this or previous episodes of the programme, you can go to our podcast page on nearpodcast.org/pcast/. Thank you very much.